This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Chi. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, it's good to have you both back in one podcast. How are you both doing this evening?
Yep, same place for once, sort of, at least virtually. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty well. I wouldn't go so far as to say all's well, you know. We're living in dangerous, interesting times, so yeah.
Dangerous and interesting times. Well, Dr. Hawk, as a political scientist, that's a bold statement. I would love to hear more. Tell us about it.
I don't even know where to begin. I mean, it's we could start a lot of different places. I just feel increased confusion and despondency every time I look at the news. there is this great divorce between public health reality and how political maneuverings are dealing with that reality. Most relevantly, which we've talked about, I think, before, within the last couple of weeks, the sort of total disconnect from natural immunity being part of any kind of long-term herd immunity plan or any part of the discussion whatsoever, that this absolute fixation on mandates and apps to support mandates at the cost of the reality that vaccinated people are equally capable of spreading COVID around, of contracting it and spreading it around, and with this total denial of natural immunity. Those two things, even if we were just to start there in the face of everything else that's going on, and I don't know where all Doug wants to go, but, you know, looking at what's happening in Australia in particular this week has caused me great despair. But even if we just started with that kind of public policy disconnect, it's unlike anything I've ever witnessed before. And I have run out of ways to make sense of it. And so, you know, when you run out of ways to make sense of things, you can try evolutionary psychology. And it'll generally help you understand a little bit of what's going on. So I guess that's kind of what we wanted to do, at least for the few minutes of the show this week before we get into the other stuff. But yeah, It's a set of circumstances that is either accidentally or by design very apathy inducing. It's very difficult to know what to do to make any kind of difference to the trajectory that it seems things are on, with a permanent surveillance pharmaceutical state creeping into our lives and governing every aspect of them. For those of us who are students of political science or history, or both, the writing is really on the wall with that, and it's very discouraging. It's very demobilizing, and I don't know. Maybe I'm just going through the various stages of grief.
Yeah. So, using what we have is we got a very interesting, complicated, literally global mess. You know, it's literally all of humanity is involved in this. So this is a bizarre time. So this isn't just, you know, Israel against Iran or something in the Middle East, and we're all watching and taking sides and battling it out in Congress about what we should be doing about it, etc. No, this is everybody has skin in the game. And so so this began its life, You know, we can debate about whether or not this was created. I think there's a good chance that it was. But if it was only merely a playing around in the lab and then having a natural mutation escape, which I think is unlikely, but it did, it got out. And now we have a worldwide mess. And so this begins its life as a threat to, you know, some percentage of humanity, and an inconvenience for all of us as we're all trying to figure out, you know, how it works and what should we be doing, you know, collectively, and what should we be doing individually, and at what part is the government, you know, and government's going to play, and do we have a United Nations and World Health Organization and all kinds of scientists all over the place. So we've got a problem of humanity against nature is what we have. And before too long, we figure out that there are parameters to the problem. We can figure out that it's going to kill more or less, you know, something on the order of 0.5% of the individuals that it infects. And we find out further that what that really means is that it's going to kill 3% of people, you know, over 80, and it's going to kill very few, you know, other people. And so it winds out that it's not a particularly dangerous thing for people under 50 years old. But then something bizarre happens. So then we get a theory that what we all need to do is we need to somehow dampen down the spread so that, you know, maybe stamp it out. Maybe we can get it to extinction if we behave carefully enough and do our very best to isolate and stand 6 feet away and wear a mask. If we all do this very fastidiously, maybe we can, you know, sort of, it's kind of like smothering a fire. And if we can smother the fire, then we can save the 2-3% of elderly people that might die if they would otherwise contract the virus. Well, it becomes apparent that isn't going to fly, that the virus is going to mutate to forms that are going to be highly infectious. It's going to weave its way into every place imaginable. And it turns out that a virus is not the same thing as, you know, stopping people from wearing red shoes, for God's sakes. In other words, you can't see the virus. You don't even know half the time if you've got it. And there's going to be it doesn't respect. I mean, we have these incredible concepts about how the Canadians aren't going to let people from one province go to another province. It's like, well, the virus couldn't give a damn about the boundaries, what you do. It's going to find its way all over the place. Sooner or later, it's going to get to places where it has not been. And so the concept of smothering the virus winds up being a ludicrous concept, but it has some merit for a short period of time when there's the idea of let's keep the lid on the pot until we can possibly get a vaccine, or we can also discover treatments. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, that made some sense. So that's what we saw. We saw heroic and extraordinarily expensive actions taking place by governments in Singapore and Vietnam or whatever, and in Germany, heroically shutting down their countries and everybody hiding in their houses while we're sitting there praying for the scientists to come up with something. But then we find something fascinating take place. We find that there's virtually no energy at all and no government support, no interest in treatment. That what you have is a massive top-down 110 trombones, 76 trombones and 110 trumpets or whatever it is. It's all about the vaccine. Okay? So it's vaccine, 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 vaccine. That is the only viable solution. And we wind up with a bizarre logic. And the bizarre logic is, even though it basically doesn't kill anybody under 50, which is like 70% of the United States population, and 80, you know, probably 80% of Brazil or whatever it is, even though that's true, no. Now the concept is everybody needs to be vaccinated. And we stand back and we say, that's interesting. Tell us about this vaccine. And it's not a sterilizing vaccine. It never was never intended to be, you know, and it isn't. And so as a result, when you take it, the government promised, oh, if you take it, life's going to go back to normal. We'll all stamp this thing out. Everybody do their part and get vaccinated, and then somehow we'll smother the fire. No, it's a complete lie. All very responsible, high level, you know, brilliant people said, this is complete BS. Okay, if you want to look at who those brilliant people are, we're not just making this up. Look at the Great Barrington Declaration. You got Oxford, Harvard, and Stanford University written all over it. And so it doesn't matter. These opinions of contrarians basically saying, no, this is no way to do this and it's not going to fly. Those concepts got carpet bombed from above. So this is fascinating. And now we move into an extraordinary thing that we're witnessing, which is that literally a continent has little tyrants in Australia saying, no, if you're vaccinated, you can come out and have a life. But if you're unvaccinated, you got to stay in your house. You're not going anywhere. You're not going to a store. You're not going to a bar. You're not going to a restaurant. You're going nowhere. You're not leaving the country either. Not going on a plane. This is incredible.
Not even if you're a citizen of another country.
Yeah. This is unbelievable, people. You're watching. This is like Adolf Hitler's dream. He didn't have this much control. So the question is, we might look at this from one perspective and we might say, are these people really stupid? Okay, are these people not very high in IQ? Okay, are these people, you know, somehow, you know, I've never really thought highly of politicians' intelligence. And you might think, gosh, you know, is this 115 IQ individual that really can't follow the logic down two steps? I mean, is this a person that can't do a side angle side proof in ninth grade geometry? Am I looking at the guy who slithers by with a B minus in ninth grade geometry? Is that what I'm looking at here? Can't look through three steps of logic? I don't think so. Okay. I don't think it's possible for these people to be that stupid. I don't think Joe Biden's that stupid. I don't think Gavin Newsom's that stupid. I don't think that, you know, who's the guy in Canada? Is that Trudeau? Who is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think he's. Jr. No, I don't think he's that stupid. I don't.
He might be. God. He might be that stupid.
I don't. Angela Merkel, list. Damn sure isn't that stupid.
No, she's okay. Not. But Trudeau, I don't know.
Maybe. But the point is
that we could have an argument.
They all can't be this stupid. Okay, and so the underlying logic, in other words, up until late July, you could make a case that the CDC, which had been absolutely misinforming everybody and very carefully shading the truth all over the place, that people looking to them, if you're a Gavin Newsom and you are looking at the CDC and the CDC is telling you on April 1st, hey, vaccinated people won't spread the virus, okay? Even though we had no reason to believe that virus would be sterilizing. None. Okay, so very quickly we find out, you know, 100 days later, now it's spreading all over the place. And so the watershed date for us to understand that we were actually in an interesting new level of trouble was by about August 7th or 8th or 9th. By that time, you had evidence from studies in Vietnam that are going to be published in The Lancet, I believe. And you have study out of the University of Wisconsin, and you have studies out of the University of California, San Francisco. You've got evidence all over the place, okay, saying, hey, the vaccinated people are spreading the virus like crazy. They are in no way safer to you if you're standing next to one of those than if you're standing next to an unvaccinated person. No difference. Okay, that fact I could understand. It might take a few days for some dumb politician with 115 IQ to have that seep through their head and then have to figure out how they're going to backtrack and then how they're going to have to break the news to their constituency that it's a little different than they were saying before, and it turns out that the game is different than we thought. But that is not what we're seeing. We're seeing them march forward, looking to take greater control and basically wind up with an apartheid state. That's incredible. So Gavin Newsom and the other 30 governors in the United States, they are not that stupid. They have to be listening, and they know the facts about why 20 governors in the United States have said, we are making it unlawful for you to have an apartheid state in our state. It's not going to happen. It's against the law. Okay. Now, so we have a fascinating situation. What on earth could this motive be? Now, I talked to a person whose father was a politician in another country. And he said to me, you know, the way we think in our family of politicians is they are like cheerleaders. Like, wherever people are cheering, that's what they tout. Okay? Like they don't really think that deeply. They just try to sniff the wind and find out where the biggest cheering is, and that's where they go.
Okay? Job number one is get reelected. It's yes. Not to do anything in particular. It's to right. Preserve your job.
Right. Yeah. And so that is a possibility. And mm-hmm. if we have to look at that rather than look deeper and more, you know, for more sinister corners. It could be that literally the most obvious reason these politicians are going directly counter to all the scientific evidence and logic is because it's in their best personal political interest to do so because their constituency is that stupid.
Yeah, their internal polling is telling them that's what they should be doing.
Is that possible?
People who are most disagreeable are going to scream the loudest, and so they'll make it look like, you know, they're the majority?
I mean, to some degree, but I think most of these guys have pretty sophisticated, legitimate
yes.
polling.
And sure.
There is certainly for a lot
they
of
control
this
that.
Ride, yeah. they're, you know, just the kind of innate fear of contagion and mm-hmm, all of
right.
the, you know, I think you have had a majority of people who have been very friendly toward, well, we need to do what we can. These are the
right.
majority of people don't have a historical perspective on state power and how reluctantly it gives up its grip once it has consolidated a little more control. I
yeah.
think the intuition that most people out there in Western democracies have, because they've never known anything else, we live in a post-Cold War world mostly, that it's, you know, well, yeah, you might have to take some pretty drastic measures short term when you're facing something really unusual. What's so problematic about that?
Right.
That doesn't mean that you're marching toward the gulags. It just means that you're dealing with the reality of a difficult, unprecedented public health emergency. So
right.
yeah, like wear a damn mask. What's the problem? And I do think you do see a majority if we were to look at all of that survey data that someone like Trudeau is looking at, that's what they're going to see, particularly somewhere like Canada. I mean, Australia, I think, is the numbers I see are that 3/4 of the population is more or less supportive of,
wow.
of what's going on. And so, but this gets back to the principle of the nested dolls of Frank Underwood's that
yes.
we've talked about before,
right.
where Laura Logan pointed out, there's kind of the witless, the half wits, the full wits, that
yeah.
not everybody who's making political decisions is totally in on the entire game. There's a lot of people in the bureaucratic mediocre middle who are making decisions to preserve their election prospects, to please their donors, to play well in a certain district. They're doing things that are expedient and that get them some kind of short-term gain that they're after without, mm-hmm. you know, in a pretty ideologically agnostic sort of way.
Right.
And they are unwitting pawns in someone else's game. So there could be more sinister motives above them, but they're
right.
just acting predictably in their own self-interest to get themselves reelected. I think that's a huge part of the story.
Boy, that, you know, there's something, I mean, the nice part about that is that, you know, I don't, like my guess is, God knows, I don't know, only just a good-looking guy with a nice haircut is Gavin Newsom. And, Gavin Newsom just looks like some guy who's, you know, was born to play a political role, is smooth enough. I don't see him as an evil dude looking to take over the world. You know what I'm saying? I look at him as...
He looks to me like the love child of the American Psycho character and Gordon Gekko. But maybe that's just me. I think it's the haircut. So I don't see him as a particularly nice, friendly face. Like, I don't want that guy, you know, kissing my babies.
Yeah. I think a few years ago, we went over a study that said that there's certain politicians with certain whiter facial characteristics are actually lower, or perceived as lower conscientious. And so when I see Gavin Newsom, I see those whiter facial.
Oh, cues. Yeah. You know, he's snorting up something in a restaurant bathroom.
Yeah, I mean, I just look at these guys and I see, you know, in that guy probably some 125, 130 IQ dude whose job it was from the jump to just, you know, he had a basically a yellow brick road just lined out in front of him, obviously his aunt being Nancy Pelosi and coming from great wealth. But I don't see him as anything other than a little midget, you know, what do you call that, a half-wit, that is just doing what he's supposed... Yeah, he's just a half...
He thinks he knows why he's doing what he's doing.
Right.
And that's what the half-wits are. They think that they're in the know. They think they know more than the little people do. And they're acting in their own interest and also the best interest of their constituency, presumably, or they wouldn't get reelected.
Right.
But yeah, that's a classic example of a half-wit. He does not understand the larger interests that his behavior is potentially serving. He's just totally blind to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we can only speculate on what that is.
Right. And that's where we get wild speculation. But when you get so much of the same, like it could be, you know, it's kind of like, you know, convergent evolution. You know, I mean, there's like principles, like if you're seeing a lot of the same kind of behavior in a lot of different places around the globe. You're not seeing it uniform, but you're seeing places, you know, New Zealand, Australia, New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco. You're seeing, and certainly in some other places have been, you know, I don't know a lot about what's been happening in Asia, but I think there's been an awful lot of draconian, you know, lockdown behavior in Asia.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So some of this obviously comes about because of, stupidity, ignorance, fear, misparameterization of the problem by people in charge, and possibly, you know, obviously well-meaning, like Merkel is trying to lock down Germany in some ways. It's like she's not stupid. And I don't think that, I don't know if Merkel's part of some big, bizarre, you know, underhanded takeover, you know, world domination theory. I have no idea. I just can't imagine that would
be
true.
Does the G7 count? I mean, it just depends on our perspective. She certainly is from a certain perspective.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, who knows? And of course, when you back the camera up, you're thinking, okay, all right, there's two hypotheses, which is that this is just a political and resource grab shit show, disorganized, kind of chaotic, opportunistic. Some people that are put in happen to be in some positions of power, have special interests associated with them, so they push a bullshit agenda. If you're an Anthony Fauci, you know, you're on the side of your buddies in big pharma, etc. And so. You keep touting some utterly absurd ideas, and you're looking to have everybody in the damn country vaccinated for which is just a terrible health policy, and you don't care, and you know it's a terrible health policy, but it's in the best interest of whoever it is your overlords and buddies and constituents are. So, you know, I you could see that. And you can see that that's just self-interested, you know, sociopathic behavior. But I guess the real question is, and I think the question in a lot of our minds are, is this way top down? Okay. Is this way top down? Are there a dozen people that are actually guiding this show? You know, what is their end game? And if that is true. So that's the question that obviously a year ago when we're talking about coronavirus, I'm just shrugging my shoulders about it, waiting for this thing to be over, thinking that this is a stressor on humanity and it's a threat to a few people. And it's scary, and we're hopeful for treatments. You figure that medicine, when it comes to acute infectious disease processes, modern medicine's pretty damn good. I mean, they're good at that stuff. And so you figure that with some time, they would get very good at it, and et cetera. So we'd figure that we would work our way out of a problem of, you know, that it would go from an acute, pretty serious, scary thing to much less, et cetera. Now this is no longer a problem of human beings against COVID virus. It's free human beings against individuals that have various and sundry different motivational positions that are out to be very controlling. This is weird. And I'm not sure, you know, we could talk a little bit about, there's only a couple of motives that, you know, there's a few things that motivate people. So power motivates people, you know, power to get resources over other people, status, which is a currency that they can use. It's basically resources writ large, which includes status and money effectively. Money and or literally political machinery control. So anyway, I'm just rambling here because I'm lost. I think as a lot of people are at trying to see the rationale that is driving this, because we know the rationale that is ostensibly driving it. It cannot be driving it because the people that are driving it cannot possibly be this stupid. That's where we stand today, and that's what makes this very disturbing.
Yeah. I don't know that you need a secretive cabal, secret society with masks and sex orgies to set the agenda for the entire globe necessarily. Not that that doesn't exist. We it certainly could. But I think if you just followed up the incentives from the half-wits to to the half full wits, not quite the full wits. Let's say that the full wits are all the way at the top, and we don't even know who those people are. They're ancient bloodline bankers, and
we know that Bill Gates is clearly one of them. You know, we recently learned that Bill Gates basically owns the World Health Organization. Which is something that I did not know. So Bill Gates is.
But even Bill Gates may be like the top half-wit. You know, there definitely could be puppet masters above Bill Gates. So like this is all a thought experiment. But you could have a lot of half-wits that do have power seeking, status seeking, money seeking agendas behind something like a social credit vaccine passport program. You link those two things together. This is a grand pretext to get people digitized and map them and map their interests and their desires and what they want, what they'll pay for, what they fear, everything that anyone who wants to make money off of them or get a vote from them could ever possibly want to know. There are a lot of people in the mediocre middle who would want their paws on that information or some part of that information. And so if you promise them little cookie crumbs of, hey, you know, if we implement this, it's going to help you get reelected, it's going to help you do better fundraising, it's going to help you make a bunch of money off of this or that, whether it's a pharmaceutical intervention or any of the downstream. I mean, there are a lot of places to be made to make money off of, not just the pandemic, but even beyond the pandemic. Once you have people nicely tied up with a little bow on an app, I mean, we already have huge data analytics on people, but it's troublesome and expensive to consolidate that data. So if you're a big corporate interest that wants to make money off of people. It's cumbersome. You can kind of corral their data. You can get a sense of what they want and what motivates them. But it's just not as easy. It's not as cheap as something like this would be if you had access to it. So I just think all along the way, all the way up to the secret cabal,
right.
You have plenty of people who would like to see that affected, and even if not for raw power and money, for the status of saving the world, for the status
right.
of doing the right thing, of controlling overpopulation, reducing the effects of climate change, things that are good claims to make, whether or not they're based in any sort of reality, but again confer a certain social status that helps you consolidate more money and power.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. 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 So we can speculate all we want, but I really do think it comes down to, just nested dolls of interests serving each other and then serving a higher interest right above them.
Yeah.
So what do we do about it? I mean, I know in the famous quote in the famous movie, one of my favorites, National Treasure, as spoken by Nicolas Cage, if you have the ability to respond, then you have the responsibility. So what ability do we have to respond to this?
Well,
that's the big question.
Yeah, I think that you, this is, I think Jen explained this to me, I don't know, 2-3 months ago when we started sniffing that this was big and scary and like an almost unimaginable level threat to human freedom as we know it. And so Jen being Jen and her obviously deep knowledge of political science and political history, it was basically educating me on how extraordinary that the founding fathers were in tying their own hands and trying to devise a government that would distribute power in such a way that nobody could ever get control like this. And so that this is that in fact, though, that the temptation is always there. If you think about this, there's three ways to get resources in the world, really. There's three basic functions. One of them is to trade for it. In other words, do something for the other person and then they'll do something for you. The other way is to force it. In other words, threaten at the point of a gun, I'm going to just take it from you. And the third is to trick you. That's fraud. So the notion of an idealized government is one that essentially has a monopoly over the force so that you can't have a mafia running around out there or your next door neighbor leveling a gun at you and telling you to move your fence over, so that he has more of your land. In other words, the notion is that by having a government with a monopoly over force, then it frees citizens to settle their disputes with dispassionate third parties. And we minimize the conflicts of interest so people can't use force against each other and they can't defraud each other because then they're going to wind up in civil court or possibly criminal court, lose their freedom behind that and lose their ill-gotten gains and have to pay penalties. So the notion is to try to make as much human action as possible free transactions between voluntary individuals. That is what freedom is. The government doesn't tell you who you can transact with and what you can transact about, so long as you're not forcibly interfering on other people's rights, et cetera. And so this is where the vaccine comes in. It's like, well, if you're carrying around the vax, you're carrying around the coronavirus and you're not vaxxed, or you're going to get the coronavirus because you're not vaxxed, then you are infringing on my rights, et cetera, because I've got a grandmother who's immunocompromised and you could spread the virus to her. Even though I'm vaxxed and she's vaxxed, it still could hurt her, et cetera. And of course, now we know that the vaxxed person is just as likely to spread it to his grandmother. In fact, he's vastly more likely to spread it to his grandmother than I am because he's in her house. So the concept of a social responsibility behind the vaccine, this specific non-antiseptic vaccine, is completely gone. There's no justification at all. The however, what we're watching is we're watching force and fraud. We're watching wholesale, massive force and fraud on a continental level. And so now this is precisely what the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights, et cetera, was all about. The whole idea of the United States was, hey, we're going to have a government by the people, for the people, where we're going to do everything we can to promote the general welfare by trying our best to eliminate force and fraud out of a transaction of free individuals. That's the whole idea. Okay. It took us 100 years or so or less to get rid of slavery as a concept, i.e. we were forcing people to do our interests. You know, not me. I wasn't there, and I'm not responsible for anybody who did. But the point is that the but little by little, we expanded human freedom over a couple of hundred years. We got better, okay? We did a better job. And now we're suddenly taking a sharp turn in the other direction. And it's scary. And we can all feel with the big hammer of high tech, you know, high data analysis, ability to track everybody, you know, cameras everywhere, you know, listeners, electronic listeners with massive computer programs on the internet who can analyze who you are, what you're going to do. They can think about, you know, when you're about to get a chocolate donut before you know that you're going to be thinking about that. And so that suddenly we are watching the birth of Big Brother and the force behind that. And also, quite frankly, people, vast, widespread, unabashed fraud as the government absolutely distorts its information about this issue and is not being straight with the people at all. This is amazing. So now we, yeah, what do you do about it? Well, one thing that you do is you don't stand in the middle of an avalanche. You know, so you understand that your responsibility is not to save the world. That's a mistake. Your responsibility is to figure out how to live your life in the best way possible. I liken this to us being in the middle of a war, but look, you know, gunshots aren't being fired. The other kind of shots are. The you know, there isn't literal violence taking place, which is good. Okay, so if you look at the standpoint from where this country and other countries we would have hoped should be in terms of the governments having a commitment to the force and fraud concept of free citizenry, a government by the people, for the people. That, you know, that is no longer in place right now. Okay, that's not what you're seeing. So now that that's not what you're seeing, it's like, okay, now you have to start thinking about, now you are, now there's a war over this concept. So we are no longer in an expanding freedom process that we have been in for 250 years in the United States. We are now in a reversal. We don't know how acute it's going to be. We don't know how long it's going to go for. We don't know. All we know is this, and this was what Jen was educating me on this, and Charles Murray was making this point in our interview with him, and that is that you know, freedom is like a garden, and the jungle's always trying to take over. And the jungle that's involved is actually largely driven by energy conservation programming in the heads of animal life. And those animals are people who, there's a reason why force and fraud are so dangerous. They are biologically efficient under certain conditions. In fact, they're biologically efficient under a lot of conditions. If my village is three times bigger than your village, I've got bigger warriors than you, then I can just threaten you and take your stuff, and there's not much you can do about it other than die. You know, and you can be the young king of Maui that at 27 years old was killed by Kamehameha. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed your noble short life. There's a plaque in Lahaina, you know, to you. Oh, well. The so
he has a whole park, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's a whole park.
Yeah,
yeah. The yeah. So I forget where I was going. I lost the track a little bit. Go ahead, Jen. But if you can pick up a thread here, I don't know where it is.
Yeah, it's just that force and fraud are biologically programmed.
Yes,
And that yeah, we. I mean, I think this starts. I mean, I always go back to that great documentary series, House of Cards. we have so much to learn from House of Cards, or without spoiling it too much for people who haven't seen it. I think even it's just in the, you know, sort of cultural zeitgeist that they are corrupt politicians who will do anything to hold on to power. But it doesn't start off that way. You mm-hmm. know, it starts slowly. It starts innocently enough. You're in a close race, and it's just a slight advantage to, you know what your constituents are searching for, or to know a little bit about their internet behavior, or, you know, any extra data that you can get in a close democratic election is mm-hmm. going to be to your advantage. And if you have to kind of, you know, cut a few corners to get it, and it's maybe that, you know, people wouldn't be too pleased if you had it, you know, it's a little dirty, but it's fair enough. And it just it starts off that way, and then of course the rest of the series shows you where it goes in this very extreme sense. But I think that's it's this instinct for, you know, yeah. competitive advantage, and
yes.
which is necessary for survival and reproduction.
Right.
And so you get a little competitive advantage. You get it however you can get it. You weave yourself a narrative that justifies it, so you don't feel mm-hmm. like a terrible person. Mm-hmm. And then you've taken a little step forward, and then from there you take another step forward. And anything that is consolidating surveillance over the population that could be mm-hmm. parceled out to a lot of interested parties is just going to be a very potent resource for a lot of different individuals and stakeholders. And so we have this predilection toward force and fraud mm-hmm. that is deep in the species, as it is with most any species. And there you go. Like you deceive as much as you can, you deflect as much as you can, and when all fails, you carry a big stick, you deploy a little force.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Useful
and,
for people.
And you believe yeah. subjectively yes. the whole time that it's the right thing to do. It's in the interests of everybody's well-being and public health. And yeah. You know, I think these half-wits,
yeah.
these Daniel Andrews, the Premier of Victoria, you know, is like mm-hmm. this archetypal evil bureaucrat,
yeah.
absolute archetypal half-wit. I think he subjectively genuinely believes that he's doing the right thing, that he mm-hmm. has to be the bad guy to you know, maybe it's not going to be popular, but you'll thank me later. It's for your own good, let alone the fact that it's ultimately his own interest that's being served.
Yeah. And I'm sure that President Xi, you know what I mean, feels the same way, that this is all, you know, these are people that don't have a lot of, you know, self-awareness as to, you know, the inherent, they don't have the personality to understand the beauty of freedom and the notion of trade. It's like, no, they're going to use force and fraud. You know, well, first they made trade. So they offered people, you know, Joe Biden was offering people $100 bucks to get a vaccine.
$100, you know, a drink,
a joint,
a lap
sure.
dance, like all of those things were offered in the early days. And so,
sure.
yeah, you promise sex, drugs, and rock and roll and money
yes.
and everything. And hey, you know, this, you take it now
right.
or you're going to pay later.
Yep. There you go. Yeah. So I think that, you know, freedom as an animal is a myth. If you're trapped in a cage in a zoo, you're pretty safe, but you got a lousy existence. If you are out in the wild, you are subject to force and fraud all over the place. If you're a Thompson's gazelle, the tiger that's laying in the grass is fraudulent. You know what I mean? That tiger's pretending that they're just a bunch of grass there, and they're trapping you. And so
their coats are fraudulent. Their physical features are deceptive. The colors and the patterns that they are in order to be better camouflaged. It's just completely built into nature.
Yes. And so would be the self-deceptive, sanctimonious psychologies mm-hmm. of semi-sociopathic, disagreeable politicians who believe that they know what's in the best interest, despite the fact that all reasonable evidence is absolutely contradicting what they're saying. But that evidence would say, oh no, now we got to go back and take our luck with trading freely with people and trying to pitch what we have versus our competitors in some open election kind of process, or forget it, not a chance in hell. So yeah, we are, what do you do about it? What you do about it is you keep your eyes wide open, and you watch for, you watch this process, and I would say, depending upon where you are in the world, you know, we talk to people, Jen and I talk to people all around the world, and some people's circumstances are an awful lot worse than we are here in the United States. So in the United mm-hmm. States, you have a great deal of freedom. You have a lot of control. You have to put up with a tremendous amount of hassle if you want to necessarily duck around. Like if you live in Los Angeles or San Francisco right now, your life isn't terrible. But in other words, if you're an unvaccinated person, if you decide not to be vaccinated, which I believe should absolutely be your right, and you have good reason to be suspicious about the cost-benefit analysis of this. And even if it turns out that ultimately the data analysis, if it's ever fairly done 3 or 4 or 5 years from now, and it turns out that you were wrong, you might have survived, but you dodged a bullet that you could have more easily protected yourself with the vaccine, then fine. Okay. It was your choice. And if it turns out that you were suspicious, didn't get a vaccine and died, then you took your gamble. You took your shot and you did it your way. I have to tell people that by far the most important thing that you can do to protect yourself is not a vaccine; it's your own personal health. Your own personal health is by far the most potent thing that you could do to reduce your odds of death, no matter who it is that you are. So that's the biggest variable that there is. You know, how good is your lung capacity? That's a big deal. You know, what is your obesity level? What is your blood urea nitrogen level? In other words, how much animal protein are you eating? Because that winds up being a tremendous predictor of whether or not people have a severe COVID response or die. Okay, so these things, you know, you have tremendous control. Nobody talks about that. Our public health officials, it's all about this vaccine, which, by the way, in no way insulates you from a bad course of COVID or death. It reduces your odds if you're in a susceptible group. We don't know what the total score sheet is. Why? Because they have never done the appropriate random assignment to condition longer term outcome study. They never did it. The only outcome study they have is after 4 to 6 months or whatever this was. Out of 21,000 people that got the vaccine, 15 of them were dead. And 21,000 people that didn't get the vaccine, 14 people were dead. That's the score. Okay? The appropriate way to judge an intervention is long-term analysis of all-cause mortality. Okay? It's not to look at the piecemeal data sets that we are being given access to now. Do I believe that some lives are being saved from this vaccine? Undoubtedly. I have no doubt that some lives are being saved. How many? At what cost? Okay. And what will the entire score sheet be when we looked at it in retrospect, honestly, after 5 years? Who the hell knows? I don't have a clue. Okay. And you know what? I don't know that anybody does right now. So
certainly not right now.
No. How could you?
Not even Sam Harris.
nobody knows. You can suspect, yeah, and you can have a big, strong opinion, and you can point to subsets of data. But if you why on earth wouldn't we have had a 1-year random assignment to condition study that would not have stopped us from continuing an open, an emergency use authorization? That would be fine. But at least a year from now, we could look at those 21,000 people in each group and count the dead bodies and
well,
we could see
it as an ethical impossibility, right?
Because
if you're seeing the benefit, then you can't keep it blind. You have to administer
such
the,
a great
treatment.
Benefit, so Jen, because 15 were dead in the vaccinated group and 14 were dead in the unvaccinated group, and that's the big benefit, apparently. Apparently, it's a good thing to have one more person dead. Yeah.
I think it's you know, I want to make sure to distinguish between, you know, it's not a question of getting vaccinated or not getting vaccinated that I'm talking about with my my sort of descent into anti-democratic purgatory here. So I think there are individual CBs that it makes a lot of sense to get the vaccine for certain people. And I think there is some evidence for benefit, just like you're talking about, without this long-term context of what the full CB is, because nobody
I would
has
agree.
That. But I think for certain individuals, if it makes sense for you in your situation and your context to get it, then by all means, get the vaccine. We're not here to tell you not to do it, but I am here to tell you that you know, you ask what can be done, what can be done about the direction of state power and the I don't even know how to characterize it, the deterioration of democracy, I guess.
Yes.
Is don't comply. Get the vaccine, but don't get the passport. Don't patronize businesses that require it. Don't use the vaccine as an excuse to go back to normal life when there's half the country that isn't going to do it and won't do it. Don't trade your comfort and your little joys of life for fundamental principles of freedom and liberty. So this requires this moment requires, from my perspective, the very people who are, you know, potentially benefiting from the deployment of something like a surveillance passport or a movement pass or whatever we want to call this.
Yes.
It's those people who need to resist that carrot that, hey, if I have this, then I can go to my favorite restaurant, I can go to my favorite pub and meet my friends, and so I'm fine. I don't have to worry about it. That's the real treacherous, dangerous slope here. And so it's not just up to people who are resistant to the vaccine to resist and protest and scream and cry and everything else that they're doing. This is a joint effort of everybody, no matter where you fall on the vaccinate, don't vaccinate spectrum, to reject the overreach of state power to Trojan horse in a bunch of pharmaceutical surveillance in with you going to your favorite pub and meeting friends for a drink. Like, screw that.
Totally.
That is where people really do have a responsibility to each other and to democracy.
Jen, thank you. I had not thought of that, but it's a civil rights movement. It's like, don't patronize a restaurant that won't allow black people in the restaurant. Like, what are we doing? Okay, just don't go there. Boycott them till they starve to death. That's exactly what we should do. And so that is a remarkable and elegant insight. And of course, it's asking people, you know, it's asking people to do something that they're not going to want to do. But right. That is, if anybody asks, you know, what can you do? Well, that is something that you could do. And that's a fascinating, you know, that's an absolutely remarkable idea. I don't think it has a political or practical future, but that doesn't mean it's not elegant as hell.
Most important ideas don't, but I think that's necessary. And if that doesn't happen, then we really are lost. So that's our last stand.
Yes. What do you know?
Well,
you know,
we were supposed to just bitch about this for the first part of the show, but it looks like
we're going to bitch. That's all we're going to. Well, you know what? There's too much at stake as we watch this world turn. And we're watching, Jen and I, and Nathan, all, we are confused about the motivation that is driving such extraordinary irrationality, that we understand it must be deeply motivated and there must be tremendous payoffs, for the head of the CDC and the head, you know, Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins, et cetera. There must be great payoffs for them to be essentially touting something that is not rational. These are not stupid people. These are highly intelligent people. And so we do not understand their motivations. Their motivations are remarkably state control, status, dangerous, threat to democracy and freedom. This is extraordinary. And so We sit now in what I believe is true. I don't know very much about governments around the world, so I don't know what Switzerland's like and Denmark, and you know. So I'm talking big as somebody that doesn't know. But the United States is extraordinary in the deep thought of the fractured power base. And so that's why, you know, we've got 50 little states with 50 little independent governments. And each of those 50 states has a substantial amount of power about how they run their affairs. And so that being the case, there's a great deal of freedom left on, you know, there's a lot of freedom left in the United States, you know, in general with respect to a wide range of things. But this is amazingly strangling freedom. And yet there is a tremendous and effective pushback where the government has limited control because the states, the federal government has limited control because the states have their own individual control. How long that lasts, what it looks like, you know, the interplay between titanic forces of lawsuits, funding, threats, you know, a state versus government, federal government, we're looking for possibly major showdowns between states' rights and federal rights, and who the hell knows? But
showdowns between governors and congressional representatives who are looking toward the midterm elections too. I mean, there's and needing funding for it, and you know, having people of the same party very much at odds with each other over that. I mean, it's going to be a mess.
It's really interesting. Well, I'm hoping, obviously, that 3 years from now, it's almost forgotten, that we look back over our shoulders and this thing, you know, was a harrowing, you know, what looked like a near miss for a tremendous loss of freedom in the United States and major consolidation of power and surveillance state, et cetera, that did not happen. Or we could be looking at essentially freedom as we grew up and as I lived my life in the United States, very slowly being defended, but possibly winking out under pressure one state at a time. You know, there's a lot of big states that are that have a lot of economic muscle and a lot of congressional muscle and certainly have tremendous power and finances legally to defend themselves at the level of the Supreme Court. With all kinds of issues if they're in conflict with the federal government. So we could be looking at a 20-year, you know, or very long-term battle that takes place, or we might not. We might be looking at something that is much shorter and much more ruthless. I don't know. But I know that today I'm not panicked because I know that in the United States there is a tremendous amount of freedom left, but it is under assault in a way that I have certainly never seen in my lifetime, and I certainly never expected to see. So that's where we are, and we'll have to just keep our eyes on it as we parameterize, trying to understand the causal forces and therefore be able to maneuver in ways that serve our own personal interests. That's all we can do.
All right. Well, we've got a lot to... We've got a lot to look forward to, I hope. So,
Jen, last words. I learn more when I shut up and listen to Jen Hawk. What else comes to mind for you?
Oh, well, we should wrap up, but
yeah, okay.
I think it's I think we already are living in a deep surveillance state. I mean, Edward Snowden showed us that back in 2013 or whenever that was. It's not like we're living in a situation that is free from larger interests than ourselves, kind of knowing what we're up to and being able to manipulate us at will. It's just a question of how easy are we making it for them, and how limiting of our at least appearance of free movement and free association are we willing to give up in that process. And it's such a moment to be very, very, very wary in a way that I think is not intuitive to so many people, mm-hmm. like it is for people who have really taken a deep dive with historical totalitarian regimes and right. seen how these things, how this power is exercised behind crisis. Mm-hmm. So to not let a public health crisis and a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty and frustration with things not being normal and wanting to get back to normal and all of these things that motivate people to be like, okay, fine. You know, I'll just sign up for this app, and you know, it's mm-hmm. what's the big deal? And it is a big deal. It is a real threshold for who we are as citizens and subjects of what kind of regime that has what kind of power over us. And it's giving the regime new little knobs and levers to mm-hmm. control us and to get us to behave in ways that are of interest to it. And yeah. That process is always underway. It's been mm-hmm. creeping for, you know, a couple centuries now.
Yeah.
But it's, I think we do have a responsibility to try to slow it down and mm-hmm. to at least not make it obvious and easy and hand this stuff over to them.
Yeah. All good. Well, that's a cheerful discussion for everybody.
Yeah. That's just, life is cheerful. Yep.
Well, thank you guys so much for giving us your take on all these things. I'm sure we'll love to hear more as time goes on. It was an interesting summer, and you know, Australia has gone where Australia, I didn't expect them to go last year, but hopefully,
Australia is a whole show unto itself really unpack what's going on. I would love to actually talk to some of our Australian listeners mm-hmm. if they wanted to call in and have a conversation. I would love to do something like that, because I have one sort of perspective sitting from afar, observing this, you know, wonderful country turn into, as one of my clients called it the other day, you know, the world's largest open air prison. That's the meme. And it's terrifying to watch from a distance. And if I am wrong about what I'm seeing, if I'm seeing exaggerated claims, if I'm misinterpreting it, I would like to know that. And I would just like to talk to people about their actual experiences and to help contextualize what looks like, you know, a lot of public support for what appear to me to be rather extreme draconian measures. So. Yeah.
Well, what they say is those who don't wish to move don't feel the chains, right?
that was one of my favorite political quotes ever, Rosa Luxemburg. She's the unsung Marxist heroine. So yeah, that was my Facebook banner, ironically, for many years before I deleted Facebook. But very, very, very true.
All right, everybody.
Well, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. And we'll look forward to chatting with you guys next show.
All right, Nathan. Thanks for having us.
Sounds good.
Gotcha. Right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.